I next met with Dr. Nair Rizvi, who also presented patients from his practice, beginning with a physician with widespread adenocarcinoma and a tumor EGFR mutation.
I saw a patient just yesterday in follow-up, and it was a doctor, an anesthesiologist in the community, and he presented with stage 4 disease with bone metastases, and he had a large pleural effusion and was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma based on cytology, and the cytology really was not adequate for a diagnosis, and he embarked upon his treatment with paclitaxel, carboplatin, and bevacizumab, and came to us sort of partway through his chemotherapy for a second opinion. And so we did send him back in the middle of his therapy for another biopsy, and he did in fact have an EGFR mutation and really changed our thinking about what might be the best course of treatment for him.
And how old is this man, and was he a smoker?
He was early 60s. He was a never smoker.
And can you talk a little bit about how he presented?
He presented really with shortness of breath, you know, just increasing shortness of breath, was found to have a large pleural effusion and underwent pleuridesis of it to drain the fluid. And one of the problems with cytology, they typically won't make a cell block for any further testing. They'll just say, here's some cells and here's a diagnosis and that's it.
I've got to say, I'm a little surprised to hear about a patient in community-based practice who's a non-smoker get started on chemo bevacizumab without getting an EGFR mutation test.
Well, again, you know, it comes back to changing how you think about getting your tissue. I mean, if you're getting a diagnosis by just a chest tube and cytology, you know, you're not going to get the cells to do the molecular testing. And I think that that's still what happens a lot, where patients are being diagnosed with procedures that are not adequate to go to the next step in terms of characterizing the tumor.
But I mean, I would assume that most oncologists would, I mean, specifically in a non-smoker, here you've got a physician nonetheless, would want to see an EGFR mutation. I mean, it is sort of a new story, I guess. It's the IPAS story, but
right.
I think that's been out there about 2 years, isn't it?
It has been out there for a while. I think, though, that physicians are not changing how they procure a diagnosis. Yes, if they happen to have an old lower lobe from before they recurred in the bank, or if they happen to have a diagnosis, the IR person happened to do a core, you know, then they'll send it. But they're not thinking about what is the procedure needed to make a diagnosis. If you present with a pleural effusion, you're not likely to get enough tissue by cytology. So you need to either ask them to make a cell block from your pleural fluid, or you need to say, well, let's do a VATCH pleuridesis and make sure we get a pleural biopsy and enough tissue that way. And they have to think ahead to make sure they do the right procedure to get the tissue.
I mean, can you do a core through EBUS?
EBUS really has been challenging in terms of getting enough tissue for a molecular pathology, and you cannot do a core through an EBUS. The surgeons can do multiple FNAs to try to get enough tissue, and frankly, right now, they're at about 50-50 in terms of whether they can get enough tissue for molecular studies by EBUS.
So I'm curious, in this situation, now you've got a patient who's had, what, 2 or 3 courses of chemo-bev?
Right.
And responding?
Responding very well, yes.
Any side effects, toxicity?
Yes, he's starting to develop neuropathy from the paclitaxel.
And this is after 2 doses?
Yes.
What kind of neuropathy specifically?
Just mild paresthesia, is not affecting his ADLs. He's also developing sort of moderate fatigue on the treatment.
How much is he getting involved with reading about the disease, trying to understand it as a physician, or does he just sort of turn to you?
I think he understands it well enough to know why we sent him back for another procedure in the middle of his therapy. I think he has a good understanding, but he really hasn't done a lot of research. He didn't necessarily understand the concept of EGFR mutations and erlotinib.
Now, did he get an EML4-ALK assay also?
We've found those to be, for the most part, mutually exclusive.
Right, so you don't even bother doing it.
We're starting to do them now on all of our patients just so we can have more data to support that notion. So at the time we did his, we didn't do EML4-ALK, but now we're going back and doing them. But we haven't found patients to have both.
And what about KRAS?
Same story. We found the KRAS to be mutually exclusive with EGFR and ALK as well.
So now you have the interesting dilemma of him responding, doing so-so on the treatment, but yet knowing you've got kind of a home run hitter sitting in the dugout.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Well, there's clearly no right answer to this situation. I think that you could finish up the 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy and go on bevacizumab maintenance and then give him erlotinib at progression. You could continue the bevacizumab and add the erlotinib after the chemotherapy. There's no good answer. In this situation, he really was, after 4 cycles of therapy, was starting to get into trouble with the neuropathy and fatigue, and he was interested to going back to work. And at that point, I switched him. When I saw him yesterday, we planned to switch to erlotinib alone as single-agent therapy at this juncture, just to try to give him, based on the IPASS data, based on quality of life, based on his wish to resume work.
How do you approach dosing of erlotinib in patients with mutations?
It's a good question because it's relevant to my conversation with him yesterday. We actually did switch to the erlotinib, actually not at yesterday's visit, but when I spoke to him about a month ago, and his oncologist started him on 100 milligrams a day, and he tolerated it well. So a week or so ago, they increased him to 150 a day. And when he came to see us, he clearly had acne and had a rash in his arm. And his first concern was, how am I going to go back to work with my facial acne, and what are my patients going to think about that? And so even though it's an oral agent and it's tolerated, these side effects are real and can be as significant as with IV chemotherapy. And our goal is for patients by and large to be dosed with full dose erlotinib at 150 per day. We are able to manage their cutaneous toxicities reasonably well in conjunction with our dermatology. I would say that many of our patients are not able to tolerate full dose therapy. And I would say that we probably have as many patients who are at 100 milligrams a day as the dose they can tolerate as 150. So we don't really know whether patients are more apt to develop resistance at 100 versus 150. So we do try to give as full dose as possible.
Could you comment on the so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs? I know one of them is BIBW2992. What are these agents and what do we know about them?
So BIBW2992 is an irreversible inhibitor affecting EGFR and HER2. And in earlier phase 1 trials, there was evidence that it may be a more effective agent at targeting mutations relating to the T790M acquired resistance mutation. The thinking is that patients invariably will respond to erlotinib based on their sensitivity mutation. However, over time, eventually, really everyone will develop resistance through the emerging of a secondary acquired resistance mutation, which changes the conformation of the protein further and makes the cancer cell resistant to the erlotinib. And this BIBW2992 may be a more effective agent in terms of targeting that acquired resistance mutation. There is a frontline trial with BIBW2992 as first-line therapy in patients with known EGFR mutations that's being conducted. There is also a study combining BIBW292 with cetuximab in patients who have developed acquired resistance to erlotinib, and those are two studies that we're part of right now.
And your group has already reported some information on using an EGFR TKI, I guess erlotinib, with an antibody cetuximab. What do we know about that?
Well, the data from that combination did have compelling results that the combination may restore sensitivity to cetuximab combined with an EGFR TKI. So I think that really was the basis for this BIBW2992 combination trial.
Getting back to the reversible TKI, some of these people are progressing on, say, an EGFR TKI, but maybe others got it in the past and have been off it for a while. And that brings up the issue of retreatment with an EGFR TKI, again, which you all have published some information on. What do we know about repeat responses in people who previously had an EGFR TKI?
So, you know, there's two scenarios that relate to that. The first is another patient that I have been treating recently, again, a young man who had presented with clinical stage 3A adenocarcinoma of the lung, never smoker, and he...
How old?
He was 54, I think. And he received induction chemotherapy. This was a number of years back. So it was with docetaxel and cisplatin. And he received four cycles of chemotherapy. And he underwent resection. And he had 3A adenocarcinoma and did have an EGFR mutation. And he did go on erlotinib as adjuvant treatment. There really isn't great data to, or really any data to support that, but with 3A disease and high risk for recurrence, we chose to give him adjuvant erlotinib for 2 years. And over the two-year period of time, he got through it, but was not without some difficulty in terms of side effects, fatigue, diarrhea, skin toxicity. So at 2 years, we stopped the erlotinib, and about a year later, he did in fact recur in lymph nodes as well as lung nodules. And at that point, we did resume the erlotinib, and he was sensitive to it and has been on it for about a year now and is continuing on it with maintaining a response to therapy. So he never was truly resistant to erlotinib. It was stopped at 2 years empirically, and then when he recurred, we resumed it, and he was sensitive again. So that's one situation. The second situation is somebody who is on erlotinib for advanced stage disease, and they do progress on the erlotinib. You know, what do you do in that situation? And our experience has been, to some extent, if you stop it, there may be a flare effect. Their tumor may grow as a sensitive population of cells may remain. And so by and large, for patients who had initially sensitive and subsequent resistant disease, we typically do continue the erlotinib and add whatever our next course of chemotherapy might be to that regimen. So I think those are the two situations. Either is a patient still sensitive, in which case, you know, resuming the erlotinib alone. Are they resistant? Did they grow on the erlotinib, in which case we would keep it on but add something else.
How do you approach outside a protocol setting? And for that matter, what trials do you have open to patients with mutations, either in the adjuvant or locally advanced setting? And maybe you might want to comment on the Canadian data that was reported in that regard.
Well, I think the Canadian data, I mean, I think the adjuvant portion of that data, the patient number.
Could you just kind of go through that and explain it?
So when the subset of adjuvant patients were looked at in that trial, it wasn't clear that the patients who had an EGFR mutation and received erlotinib versus placebo, that there really was any difference in terms of how they did. And I think that that may have to do with patient numbers more than anything else. We're part of a trial right now for adjuvant. We're giving adjuvant erlotinib for EGFR mutation positive patients with the Boston group, and we're conducting a phase 2 trial in those patients. When we looked at our experience looking retrospectively at sort of patients who had resection then receive adjuvant erlotinib, the patients with 3A disease seemed to do a little bit better with adjuvant erlotinib than those that did not. So at this point, I don't know that it is necessarily the standard of care by any means to be giving adjuvant erlotinib.
Does that mean you don't do it?
I think the 3A patients, you know, have such a high risk of recurrence. My practice has been to give those patients adjuvant erlotinib. For stage 1 and 2 patients, I don't.
I wanted to ask you about a couple of papers or presentations that you've been part of, just kind of curious about. One was a paper that was published this year in Cancer, Pack Years of Cigarette Smoking as a Prognostic Factor in Patients with Stage 3B and 4 Non-Small Cell. I was kind of curious about that paper and what it looked at and what you think it meant.
I mean, I think there's no question that pack years of smoking correlates with likelihood of EGFR mutations. And the less smoking history you have, the higher likelihood of having an EGFR mutation there is. You know, that brings to mind another case of mine who was an Asian man, but he was a heavy smoker. And when he was first diagnosed a few years ago, when we weren't routinely re-biopsying patients and going more by smoking history to make determinants about likelihood of responding to erlotinib, he didn't have enough material to do EGFR mutation testing, and we treated him with first-line chemotherapy and then second-line chemotherapy, and then he was on a trial with an experimental agent that we were studying, and during that trial, he developed, you know, worsening cough, worsening hemoptysis, and also developed a new painful preauricular lymph node. And so he progressed on the trial, and we took that opportunity to send him to our cytology group who did an FNA of the preauricular lymph node, and it, surprise, surprise, came back with an EGFR mutation despite having a heavy smoking history. And we started him on erlotinib. His cough and hemoptysis have resolved, and he had a wonderful Christmas and New Year. So, you know, smoking says so much, but the mutation result trumps everything. And I think that in someone who has some smoking history, in some ways, it's even more important to know what their profile is, because if it's a 5% chance of him having a mutation, that can be life-changing for him.
And you've reported quite a few patients out of Memorial who were smokers like him who had mutations.
Absolutely.
I wonder what's going on in practice. I'm going to guess most people who are heavy smokers aren't getting tested.
That may be.
And I'm going to guess there's no breast cancer patient that doesn't get a HER2 in ER.
Right. You know, now with ALK, I mean, that's another target, again, speaking to having to have that tissue. You know, it's all important. We're also, when we do our profiling at Memorial, we also test for PI3 kinase. We test for MEK. We test for HER2. We test for RAF, because there are targeted therapies for all of those genes that patients can be part of a clinical trial for. If you look at a never smoker with adenocarcinoma, about 85% of those patients, will we be able to identify some sort of EGFR or some other mutation which could have a potential therapeutic implication? It's not as high with the patients with a smoking history, but the list is growing and the percentage numbers are growing.
What's new in squamous cell cancer? It seems like all the excitement is in adenocarcinoma. And I'm particularly curious what you thought about the new data set that came out looking at nab-paclitaxel and the effect they saw in squamous cell. You had published a paper in the JCO in 2008 also looking at nab. What are your thoughts about it today?
Well, you know, we did have a positive experience in terms of our phase 2 experience as single agent therapy in that trial. It was first-line single-agent weekly therapy, and it was a patient population that was sort of more in the older, not-as-good PS-type patient population because it was really single-agent, and we had a very good outcome. I think the more recent data with nab-paclitaxel in squamous patients is a really important result. I know how to explain it, and the regimens, the schedules were a little bit different, but I think it's worth following up on. We are not routinely using nab-paclitaxel for our patients. And I think it would be worth looking at the squamous patients specifically with nab-paclitaxel. Our practice has been really to use it in patients who have had any sort of allergic reaction. Our threshold, we actually really do like nab-paclitaxel a lot, and our institutional guidelines are really to limit it to patients who have intolerance or reactions to standard taxane therapy, but our threshold is very low. Any sort of reaction, we switch very easily. Even our patients, my practice has been, if they have sort of difficult diabetes, I won't even treat them with docetaxel or paclitaxel, and we'll give nab-paclitaxel from the get-go. So we're starting to use it more and more for our patients.
Yeah, I've been trying to tease out in breast cancer what advantages, if any, exist over conventional paclitaxel. And you know, I don't know, the average patient with lung cancer, maybe he's older or who knows what, maybe more comorbidities. But you have used it, at least as part of a research study in the past. Do you have any thoughts other than specific situations, as you mentioned, with diabetes or whatever? For example, if the cost and reimbursement of NAB were identical to paclitaxel, would that affect at all what you did?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's not an infrequent walk for me to go from my clinic over to the infusion area, you know, on a daily basis for one or more patients who's in the middle of a paclitaxel or a docetaxel reaction. And it's a scary process for our patients. And in some cases, it's a grade 5 problem for our patient. And so, you know, my interest in sort of switching away from solvent-based taxanes is very high, and I would think it would be a good thing for us and our patients to move away from those.
I've been interested in some of the research that's going on there in looking at neoadjuvant chemo and neoadjuvant chemo-bev. Do you have any patients in your practice who are in any of those studies?
One of my trials that we've been conducting for the last couple of years is giving neoadjuvant docetaxel, cisplatin, and bevacizumab for patients with resectable stage 1B to 3A disease. And patients are also administered bevacizumab adjuvantly for a year in that trial. So we have been able to administer the bevacizumab preoperatively. What we do in that trial is we withhold the bevacizumab with the last cycle of chemotherapy so sufficient time can pass between bevacizumab and surgery. And we've presented that data in the past showing the safety profile of bevacizumab preoperatively. The efficacy and survival analysis are really ongoing.
Any thoughts of the clinical advantages of using induction chemotherapy?
I think there's many advantages, and our bias continues to be towards preoperative therapy. The advantages are that the chemotherapy is tolerated much better preoperatively versus postoperatively. Really, every neoadjuvant versus adjuvant trial shows that drug delivery is better preoperatively rather than after patients have recovered from a thoracotomy or a VATS-type procedure. I think that there's value to look for whether patients are sensitive to the chemotherapy agents, and really the only way to know whether they're responding is to show that the tumors are shrinking preoperatively. I think that there is potential for downstaging of patients. So if a patient goes from 3A to 2, they may not need adjuvant radiation therapy because their pathologic stage has been downstaged. I think that there's negatives to preoperative therapy. You don't have the full molecular profile in terms of making treatment decisions because they may not have enough material to do all the analysis. But I think overall, the pros outweigh the negatives. We've been using more pemetrexed and cisplatin as a neoadjuvant treatment for our adenocarcinoma patients, and it's been a nice combination and overall been a better preoperative therapy than the taxanes and platinums in terms of tolerability. So they're able to get through the chemotherapy much better and be more fit and better shape come surgery.
Where do you think things might be heading in terms of the two of the things you're looking at in this study? One, neoadjuvant bevacizumab, the other is adjuvant. It was just a big editorial by Dr. Van Cutsem in response to the NSABP colon negative study and the other associated negative colon study. There was a negative neoadjuvant Bev study presented from Europe at the San Antonio meeting. Not all tumors, I guess, are the same, but where do you think things are heading?
Well, I think that we've made some certain assumptions about bevacizumab that it sort of works well in all tumor types. And what we found in our neoadjuvant bevacizumab trial is that some patients, and in that trial, we had bevacizumab administered alone first, and then 2 weeks later, the chemotherapy was added. We looked at response with the single agent bevacizumab, and there was really a wide spectrum of response, how well patients responded to the bevacizumab as a single agent. So I think that may speak to maybe not our fully understanding, just like if you have an EGFR mutation, you're going to have a response to a lot, and we haven't necessarily characterized which patients may benefit the most from bevacizumab therapy.
I mean, did you see any patients who had significant anti-tumor effect with Bev alone?
We did have some patients who had significant responses in the 15 to 20% range with single-agent bevacizumab. We had some patients who had visible necrosis of their tumor with single-agent bevacizumab, so there were clear biologic responses to single-agent benefit we saw.
Let's finish out talking a little bit. We've talked a lot about all the excitement in terms of biomarker-driven therapy, et cetera. But what about the more common situation where you don't have a mutation, you've got metastatic adenocarcinoma, in terms of the way you approach the initial therapy, in terms of specific selection of chemo and how you decide about biologics, and then what kind of strategy you use for maintenance or second line? How do you think that whole thing through?
Well, I think that our group has been fairly uniform in terms of our treatment approach in the last couple of years. In terms of first-line therapy for stage 4 adenocarcinoma of the lung non-mutated, I would say that most of our patients are receiving pemetrexed and cisplatin or pemetrexed and carboplatin with bevacizumab as their first-line therapy. For squamous patients, probably most of them are receiving gem and a platinum or taxane and a platinum as their first-line treatment. We've always favored cisplatin over carboplatin as first-line therapy. I think it's been hard to do with taxanes in combination with cisplatin because they end up getting into problems with maybe diarrhea from the docetaxel and then renal compromise because they had cisplatin, or they run into problems with neuropathy with the combination of a taxane and cisplatin. So it's been hard to combine the two. With pemetrexed, it's actually been very easy to combine with cisplatin, and we found that patients get through it extremely well. They don't land up in the hospital with renal failure. They keep their hair for the most part. They don't get neuropathy, and it's been a very nice match in terms of tolerability. So patients will receive with adenocarcinoma, pemcis, bev, pemetrexed, cisplatin, and bevacizumab as their first-line therapy. And My practice has been after 4 to 6 cycles to drop the cisplatin and continue pemetrexed and bevacizumab as maintenance therapy. And patients really can continue that a long time. I have, you know, a couple of 80-year-old ladies who are on PEM, methotrexate, bevacizumab maintenance therapy, and they've been responding. They've relocated for the winter to Palm Beach or Boca, and they're continuing their chemotherapy and playing golf. And really, it's as long as performance status is reasonable, even the elderly patients have been doing very nicely. And patients actually like it. I think more patients have conceptual difficulty with what we did in the past, which is saying, okay, you know, you've done 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy. We're going to take a break now and just watch your scans. And it's very unsettling for patients to do that. And being able to continue a maintenance active treatment for patients is, I think, welcomed by our patients.
What about in the adjuvant setting? What tends to be the regimen utilized there?
I think it's very variable. You know, our practice for the most part is to go with a standard etoposide and cisplatin weekly for 4 months. And that's the most proven data. However, there is, in terms of NCCN guidelines, options with other combination therapies. I saw a patient just last week who was seen at another academic center, and they recommended pemetrexed and cisplatin as the patient's adjuvant treatment. And you know, I told them that was a perfectly reasonable choice and to proceed with treatment at the other center as they recommended. So I don't think there's one treatment which I can be dogmatic about as that needs to be the one choice.